Good morning, it's 7:08, and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Janine Etter. The U.S. Open tennis tournament is held this year from August 27th to September 9th, in part at New York's Arthur Ashe Stadium. Arthur Ashe was an internationally renowned athlete and activist who was one of the early pioneers not only for African Americans who play tennis, but also for athletes who use their platform to create social change. For much of the hour, we speak with historian Raymond Arsenault, author of Arthur Ashe, A Life. He is also the John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg. So Raymond Arsenault, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure.
You write in your book that it presents an extended meditation of three of the most important themes in American history: the consequences of racial discrimination, the movement to overcome that discrimination, and the emergence of professional sports as a dominating cultural and commercial force. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, yes. I really wanted to stress Arthur's role as a public intellectual. He was probably more of a public intellectual than any other figure in the sports world during his lifetime, and there really hasn't been anyone, possible exception of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, to replace him. And he was a committed civil rights activist from about the age of 24 for the rest of his life. He lived to be 49. So for a quarter century, he in his own quiet way, deliberative way, he was a whirling dervish, really, in terms of fighting for social justice and racial equality. And he seemed to be effortless in his ability to adapt to people and to live in a predominantly white world and to live a kind of almost jet-setter lifestyle as a great tennis champion. But he never forgot where he came from, in the Jim Crow streets of Richmond, Virginia.
So he was born in 1943 in Richmond, Virginia, and grew up in the Jim Crow South. Can you walk us through what growing up in that environment was like for him?
Well, as it was for other black children and African Americans, you know, it was cradle to grave segregation. He lived in the Jackson Ward section of Richmond, famous for the dancer Bill Bojangles Robinson. His father essentially was the manager of the largest black Jim Crow park in Richmond. In fact, his father built the house that they lived in on the park. It was sort of isolated from everybody else, and about 50 feet outside, you know, beyond the porch were a series of tennis courts. And Arthur lost his mother at age 6, and he was very kind of forlorn and withdrawn, and it was tennis that brought him back to life. There was a young student from Virginia Union who was giving tennis lessons who saw this sort of pitiful little boy sitting on the porch, and he coaxed him onto the court, and of course the rest is history. He turned out to be, even though he was emaciated and looked sickly and no one in his family had ever picked up a tennis racket before, it wasn't long before he was really a phenomenon in Richmond, although he was never allowed to play white players there till 1966, until after he graduated from UCLA. So it was always kind of bitter for him. He made his peace with Richmond and actually tried to bring an African-American Sports Hall of Fame there. And that was the origin of the famous statue that's now on Monument Avenue. It was supposed to be originally in front of the Sports Hall of Fame, which was never built. But he often said, and he was not a person to get angry or to hold grudges, but he said that the one thing that would really stick in his craw that would irritate him is he'd run into somebody from Richmond, perhaps in Europe, at a tournament, and they would say, "Oh, we're so proud of you, and I remember seeing you play at Bird Park," which was, of course, the all-white park when you were a boy. And, of course, he knew he had never played at Bird Park. He was never allowed to. He had to actually leave Richmond for his senior year and went to Charles Sumner High School in St. Louis, because at least there, St. Louis was fairly segregated too, but there was more an opening there. He could play indoors, you know, he wasn't a complete pariah the way he was in Richmond.
And I wanted to touch really quickly about his statue on Monument Avenue, because Monument Avenue is for, well, the statues on Monument Avenue are for Confederate war heroes. Can you talk about how his statue got there?
Yes, it's quite a story, actually. He was encouraging and was really the central figure behind an effort to create this African-American Sports Hall of Fame in Richmond the last few years of his life. And there was a wonderful local sculptor, Paul DePasquale, who was essentially commissioned to do a statue of Ash. And he worked closely with Ash in sort of finding out what Ash wanted it to be. It was going to be in front of that proposed Hall of Fame. But then Ash died, and Douglas Wilder, who had known Ash since he was a little boy, who was the first black governor, of course, of Virginia, took the lead to place a statue of Arthur that DePasquale was doing on Monument Avenue. And it was extremely controversial, but he knew it would be, Doug Wilder did, but he thought it would be a major turning point in Richmond's history, that it would no longer just be a kind of museum piece that celebrated the Old South and the Lost Cause and the Confederacy, but would celebrate a remarkable favorite son like Arthur Ashe. And it took several years to eventually get it there. In fact, Arthur's widow, Jean Matusami Ashe, opposed putting it there. The resistance against it, I think, she thought, well, they don't really deserve Arthur. She felt it was unseemly, and she didn't want it there, and she still feels that way today, that it was a mistake. But I think for a lot of people, it's a great symbol of hope and potential. And I've been there on Monument Avenue, and almost always there's someone, particularly people visiting from Europe or other parts of the country, who are having their pictures taken with the statue. And you know, it doesn't fit with the other statues. There's not giant pieces of granite. It has Arthur looking down at a bunch of children, and there are piles of books, and that's what he wanted. He didn't really want himself to be the center of attention. And I think that was really true to his spirit, that he loved children. He spent an enormous amount of time giving free clinics in the inner city. He helped create the National Junior Tennis League, which today has, I think, almost 500 affiliates around the country and nearly 300,000 children from inner city, basically, neighborhoods. So it really is a fitting statue. And, of course, it's fascinating now that it's in the midst of this controversy about removing the Confederate, the gallant brigadiers, as they were called, Jefferson Davis and Stonewall Jackson and all of that. And there's a kind of a local joke going around that he may be the only statue left on Monument Avenue.
And you talked about his opening up of the National Junior Tennis League. What's the impact been like on inner city youth of color who want to play tennis?
Well, I think it's been quite extraordinary. You know, traditionally, tennis in the black community was a middle class kind of activity for doctors and lawyers and undertakers and, you know, people who had some, who really were trying to strive for kind of middle class respectability. And it wasn't a working class sport at all. And Arthur took a lot of ribbing, growing up. It was considered kind of a sissy sport in the black community. And he wanted to change that, but he really wasn't so much after developing tennis players out of the black community, which he did want to do that, but he wanted to use tennis as a way to give them an opportunity to make something of their lives. So the National Junior Tennis League, which is done in the summer, their kind of most striking characteristic is that they only do tennis part of the time, and they teach them study skills and etiquette and kind of self-respect, and it's a kind of all-purpose character-building experience. And it's some remarkable people have come out of that National Junior Tennis League, some great champions. No one quite at Ashe's level, but many fine tennis players and tennis coaches, and a lot of his proteges, people who admired and respected him, have devoted their lives to continuing this tradition.
What was his class background?
Working class. His father was a very hard worker, kind of jack of all trades, who ended up running the largest black park in Jim Crow Richmond. But he was barely literate, self-made man, and Arthur had a very loving, nurturing, extended family in Richmond, but they never had any money. And he was, I think, very much out of that sort of Jackson Ward kind of culture of North Richmond. And but as he said, you know, I didn't really grow up in a classic ghetto. You know, I never saw any knifings. I never really, you know, it wasn't rat infested. He always made that point that he didn't want to overly dramatize, you know, his rise to fame and fortune. That he was very fortunate to have a wonderful, nurturing family. And of course, just a few blocks from his house in Richmond was Virginia Union University, which was a great kind of role model, I think, for the students there. And one of them, of course, was his tennis coach, a man named Ron Charity, who coaxed him into playing tennis when he was 6 years old. And so there was a kind of you might say a middle-class leaven, an image of education and it's as a route to upward mobility that he... So he never really had a desperate childhood in any way, but certainly he had his experiences with Jim Crow and with racism and being turned away from movie theaters and tennis courts and all of that. Even years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, there were some ugly incidents. But again, he took it philosophically. You know, he was able to just bear down. Try to be the best tennis player and the best person he could be.
And although he did get a degree in business administration, he said from young that he wanted to be the Jackie Robinson of tennis.
Yes, and he really didn't want to major in business administration. He was advised that that's about the only major that he could do and that would... not interfere with his tennis playing, and he knew that's what he was at UCLA to play tennis. But he went through a remarkable kind of intellectual awakening at UCLA. You know, taking anthropology classes, became fascinated with the rest of the world, with Africa, he was always a voracious reader. But as he got older, this became more and more obvious. You know, he eventually collected first editions. He was absolutely obsessed with doing the New York Times crossword puzzle every day. And he corresponded with all kinds of intellectuals, philosophers, historians, others, literary figures. He was intellectually curious and, you know, he was a, you know, kind of a professorial athlete. That was part of, I think, his advantage that as an African American, he was the first to sort of crack the endorsement market. In part because his skin was a little lighter and he had a kind of a slight build. He didn't look threatening like Mike Tyson or, you know, one of the NFL running backs. And so he was more accepted, I think, by whites. And he knew that. He didn't like that. He saw himself as a trailblazer, and so part of his persona was, you know, always being polite, you know, a paragon of sportsmanship. And of course, that grew out of his early experiences when he had very disciplinary and coaches, including his father and Dr. Robert Johnson, who kind of groomed him. As Johnson also groomed Althea Gibson earlier. They couldn't afford to have any incidents. You know, if the ball was close to the line, and the white opponent hit it there, it was always in. And so, in some ways, he was like Jackie Robinson. That he had to hold in his feelings. He could never show any displeasure or anger because he didn't want to ruin it for the people who were coming after him. Because he knew he was a racial pioneer, and he once said, I would love to have 24 hours where I could be John McEnroe. I could go to Wimbledon and throw my racket and swear and complain about the lines calls and act out. But he knew he could never do it, and he would never do it. He couldn't do that. But you could see how much he sort of kept inside, in a very controlled way. But he was true to himself. He lived up to his ideals and always did it his way.
But I did hear John McEnroe mention that he felt like he became a better person simply by being around Arthur Ashe as well, on the flip side.
He said that to me, too, when I interviewed him. And I can't tell you how many people during my interviews with them who were close to Ashe, who at one point or another in the interview broke down, started crying. They were so emotional about talking about him. A couple of them said, you know, he was the greatest person that I met in my lifetime, that he changed my life, that I only wish that I could have been more like him. I got an email yesterday, actually, from one of the Jim Parker, who played against Arthur in St. Louis when they were young. And he said, even as a teenager, he had dignity. I mean, how many teenagers have dignity? But he did have it. And even before he started speaking out publicly in 1968, which was a great turning point for him, he was totally devastated by the assassinations of Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy, whom he met a couple times and was a great admirer of.
And he played tennis with as well, right?
He did. He played tennis with Bobby Kennedy in a benefit in Washington. He saw him, I think, two or three days before Kennedy was shot.
Right.
And he never actually met Martin Luther King, but they had a correspondence, a very warm correspondence, and they were planning a meeting later that summer, of course, after the King was killed in early April of 1968. But that was a great turning point for him, 1968. He had this sort of turn towards activism, and he never looked back, and really devoted the rest of his life to fighting apartheid in South Africa, you know, working with inner city kids, all manner of anything involving social justice, civil rights, you know, rights of Haitian boat people, you name it. He was there, even though, you know, it might have appeared that he was focusing on tennis, but really, as he said a number of times in his memoir, Days of Grace, that he really, all the tennis championships really didn't really amount to much compared to his work off the court. He felt that was the legacy he wanted to leave. And so, you know, today when ESPN gives the annual Arthur Ashe Courage Awards, it's absolutely fitting that they are named for Arthur Ashe.
And technically, although he was a pioneer, he wasn't the first African-American tennis player to win the U.S. Open and Wimbledon. That was Althea Gibson. Can you talk about her influence on Arthur Ashe's life?
Well, of course, she was sort of nurtured by the same man, Dr. Robert Johnson from Lynchburg, Virginia, known to his friends and in the tennis world as Dr. J. He ran this tennis camp for young African-American kids from the late 1940s on. And Althea Gibson was his first great success story. And so everyone looked to her in those early years. And she had a tough time. She was off the streets of Harlem and was kind of rough cut, and the press was really rough on her. And it took her a while to hit her stride. But when she did, of course, she was the best player in the world. And so she was the real trailblazer, but she was also a cautionary tale for Arthur. He saw how, you know, she didn't want to be a racial symbol. She didn't want to have the weight of the race on her shoulders, and she said so to the press. And she even though I think people who knew her knew she was a lovely woman with a great personality, but it didn't come off in a public way. And so he didn't want to make the same mistakes that she did, and they developed a good relationship later in life. And there's a picture in my book actually of the two of them together in 1976 at a benefit. So he greatly admired her, but there's a great irony in a sense that all through his life people kept talking about who's going to be the next Arthur Ashe, and of course we've never really found that person. On the men's tour, I mean, James Blake, I think, came closest to that, and Yannick Noah, of course, probably came even closer, though he was not an African American, and he was a protege of Ashe's in some sense. Ashe discovered him in West Africa at the age of 11. But of course, the the next actor, Arthur Ashe, probably in a sense, became the next Althea Gibson, turned out to be the Williams sisters. And, of course, the other great young black players today on the women's tour, Sloane Stephens and others. So he really did his best to nurture young black players, but it never quite worked out, except, of course, on the women's side. And I think he would be so thrilled, really, at what has happened in the last 2 decades with Serena and Venus Williams, and with there's so many talented young African-American players. And who knows, we may yet see an Arthur Ashe on the men's side. James Blake, of course, as I said, came very close, and he just wrote a wonderful book called Ways of Grace, which is about athletes and activism. And, of course, he took the title from sort of an adaptation of Days of Grace, which had been Arthur's memoir published in 1993. But so I think there are probably more James Blakes out there. We can certainly hope so.
That was historian Raymond Arsenault, author of Arthur Ashe, A Life, speaking about the tennis player and humanitarian on this 50th anniversary of his 1968 win at the U.S. Open. Some would argue that with the exception of Muhammad Ali, there's no modern athlete that's had such an impact on the cultural and political landscape. What's your take on that?
I think that's right. A number of people have said that. The person that I actually quote in the book, at the very end of the book, is President Obama. In October of 2016, he was at a forum at North Carolina A&T in where the sit-ins began in 1960 in Greensboro, North Carolina. And there was a person on the basketball team, an African-American young man, who asked President Obama, well, I want to be both an activist and an athlete, and how can I combine them? Do you have any models for me? And without hesitation, President Obama said, well, the two athletes that I admired most in my lifetime are Muhammad Ali and Arthur Ashe, that they were the two people who taught me what it was to be a man. And he elaborated about, of course, how Ali had a totally different personality, sort of out there and over the top, and talked about how Ashe was very professorial, and he used the phrase, he conjugated his verbs. But he argued that Ashe was no less transformational than Ali, that together they really paved a way for African Americans to have a greater self-respect and a greater hope for a better tomorrow. And I mean, there have been a number of athletes who have made great contributions, you know, Bill Russell and Frank Robinson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Curt Flood and others. But as for people who have actually transcended the world of sports, I think Ali and Ashe stand out as the two who obviously did transcend and have left a quite remarkable legacy.
And what about the protests of today, like led by Colin Kaepernick, first taking a knee during the playing of the national anthem? Do you think there's any hope for the legacy continuing?
I do. I actually just wrote a piece for the New York Times, which will be coming out in early September, on this very topic. And I argue in that piece that, and I really believe this very firmly, that if Arthur were here today, he'd be 75 years old, so he'd still perhaps be in the thick of things, and he would take a knee for social justice. You know, he would do it in a respectful way, but he would not hesitate. And I think he'd be very proud of Colin Kaepernick and LeBron James and Stephon Curry and others, particularly in the way that they have not allowed President Trump to sort of pull them down to his level. You know, they haven't really indulged in the Twitter wars. They haven't tried to bully anyone. They've just gone about their business, allowing themselves to speak out on very important issues, Black Lives Matter and other things. And I think Ashe felt absolutely passionate about this. In fact, the first public speech he ever gave, which was at a church in Washington, D.C. in March of 1968, with Stokely Carmichael in the audience, it was about the responsibilities of black athletes to their communities, that they had to give back, that they had to get involved in civil rights, something he had not done to that point. And he felt a lot of anguish and shame about that. He talked about that later in his life, that a lot of what he did over the last 25 years was to try to make up for being a late starter. And he certainly did that to a large degree. So I think, I only wish that he were here to act as a very responsible voice and to reiterate the importance of athletes having the right to stand up for what they believe in. And I think he would be appalled by some of the opposition to Colin Kaepernick and to LeBron James and others.
What would you say are some of his most significant achievements as a professional tennis player?
Well, he had a number of firsts, of course, of course, winning the U.S. Open as an amateur, as the number five seed in 1968, he was helped by the fact that all the great professionals, Rod Laver and Roy Emerson and Ken Rosewall were eliminated, in upsets, and so he was able to win the first U.S. Open. But that was an amazing achievement for someone who was 25 years old. And of course, his victory over Jimmy Connors in the 1975 Wimbledon is still, I think, perhaps the biggest upset in Wimbledon history. And it was one of the great kind of joyous moments, I think, for people in the world of tennis. Connors was a great champion, but not particularly loved, certainly not by the other players. And so when Arthur was able to beat Connors in that upset, it was an amazing moment in the history of sports. But I think for Arthur, if he were here, he would say it was being such an extraordinarily successful Davis Cup player, both as a player and as a coach. He won two Davis Cups as a coach, was almost unbeaten in singles play. Only, I think, lost two or three matches in his entire career as Davis Cup. And in fact, he surprised journalists on a couple of occasions, after when he won Wimbledon in 75 and when he won the U.S. Open, and they asked him, "Is this the biggest moment in your tennis life?" And he said, "Well, no. Actually, I'm more thrilled by winning a Davis Cup match." And I think it was in a large part because he was African-American, because he was the first African-American to play Davis Cup. And it was a validating experience for him, that he was gave him full citizenship, that he was respected enough to represent his nation in the Davis Cup competition.
And what were some of his most significant achievements as an activist?
Well, I think he would say the National Junior Tennis League and all the other activities in the inner city, but I think that the one that really, I think, hit him where he lived, in an ironic sense, was, of course, the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. He took a lot of criticism in the early years. He started trying to get a visa in 1969, and it took him till 1973 to get a visa to play in South Africa, to be the first black player to play against whites there. And, of course, his idea then was that the way to beat back apartheid was engagement, not isolation. He later changed his mind about that he thought, in the end, you had to take advantage of the fact that the South Africans were so obsessed with sports that if you could eliminate them from international competition, that it might be an avenue to pressure them to eventually get rid of apartheid. But he took a lot of criticism, took a lot of courage for him to go to South Africa and to play, because people were saying, "Well, you're being used by the white South Africans." And they're able to say, "Well, we're not so bad because we let Arthur Ashe play." But he had an enormous commitment to the liberation of black South Africans.
And can you talk about his wife and his child? He just had one child, one daughter.
Yeah, Camera, who's now 30. She's actually 31, I guess, now. She was adopted in 1986. And he was just devoted to her. And people said it sort of changed him. He became more emotionally expressive. And he had a wonderful marriage with Jean Matusmi Ashe, who's a very talented photographer. Still, she lives in Connecticut now, but lived in Upper East Side of New York. And she was very much of a feminist, and she brought him around on feminist issues. He, like most of the players on the tour, he was quite a bit of a chauvinist in the early years, and she set him straight on that. And in part, that's why he became such a close friend of Billie Jean King's. And and eventually a supporter of equity in terms of the prize money for men and women. He didn't support that initially, but he came around. So he had almost a storybook marriage, really. And Jeannie has done everything she can do, really, to extend his legacy.
And he left us early in his life. He died at the age of 49. And prior to his death, he had a heart condition, which then resulted in blood transfusions in the 80s before blood was tested for HIV. And so he contracted the disease. Can you talk a little bit about his struggle with HIV up until the end of his life?
Yes, it's a tragic story. And of course, he got HIV through the transfusion in 1983. He didn't know he had AIDS till 1988. By that time, he had full-blown AIDS, and he lived another 5 years, and he didn't tell anybody. Well, he told about a dozen close friends. There were people who knew, who kept his secret, because he knew if he revealed it, there would be no more broadcasting at Wimbledon and the French Open. He probably would lose his passport. There was so much misinformation and fear and even hatred circulating about AIDS in those years. So in April of 1992, USA Today essentially outed him. They gave him 24 hours to make a public statement. Otherwise, they were going to publish that he had AIDS. And so he made this incredible statement at the HBO building in New York, where he told the world. And he at that point, he was very angry about the violation of his privacy. He felt it was wrong that he was no longer a public figure. He'd been retired, you know, for 12 years from playing tennis. But actually, over the next 10 months, he only lived 10 more months. He turned himself into a one-man movement for AIDS awareness, devoted pretty much his whole life to it in those last 10 months. And he realized that he now probably never would have done that if they had not forced him to reveal his condition. And that was probably his finest hour. I think it's one of the reasons why when he died, it was equivalent, you know, to a head of state dying. I mean, there have been few athletes who have ever had as much mourning and feeling that someone deeply important had been lost.
And what would you say is the message of Arthur Ashe's life?
Well, I think there are several things that are possible to take away from his life, but I guess it's the importance of integrity, the importance of being a truth teller. He was that above everything else. He never really took the easy road. You know, he had his eyes on the prize, to use an old phrase from the civil rights movement. You know, even though he could have become a playboy, he made a lot of money, you know, he had quite a social life, but he never let it affect his commitment to things of deeper value. And I think if we could all be a little more like that and to follow that. And today, of course, the temptations of popular culture are even greater than they were in his lifetime. And it's very easy for celebrities to be just celebrities, you know, famous for being famous. And he never liked that aspect of being a celebrity. He once compared professional athletes to sort of medieval jesters, court jesters. And although he knew you had to entertain, and it was a business after all, and he wasn't, you know, averse to that, but that's never what made him tick. You know, he had an extraordinary depth, I think, that we could all emulate and profit from trying to be like him.
So Raymond Arsenault, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was historian Raymond Arsenault, author of the new biography, Arthur Ashe, A Life. He is also the John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg.